Did everybody have a good time at the party last night?
Woo!
And it's only just begun. My name's Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Foxborough Keep It Simple group in Foxborough, Massachusetts. And my sobriety date... My sobriety date is November 25th, 1992. And we have a special needs section over here. If anybody needs, can sit where you are, or if you need some extra room, feel free to move. And let's see. We start this meeting with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. We've got three great speakers, and I'm just going to get right to it and announce Jane C. from Minnesota.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jane C., and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the committee convention or the convention committee for inviting me, and especially Charlie Craven, our Northern Area 35 delegate, for putting my name in. It's truly a privilege and an honor to be here. The last international was held in my backyard in Minneapolis, and I was just short of a year sober. I had tried many, many, many times to get sober, and so I had about, I suppose, in July, and my sobriety date is July 26, 1999. And I was with my sponsor at this international, and I really, for years and years, had all these preconceived ideas about what Alcoholics Anonymous was and what it would or would not do for me. And I remember going to that international and just being truly amazed, you know, at what I was surrounded with. You know, and the power of this field. And I also knew that the people that came to these things were truly committed members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really why what I need to be surrounded with is people who are committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, my home group is the St. Cloud call-up meeting. It meets on Tuesday nights in Bethlehem Church at 7:30 in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And if you're ever in the area, we welcome you to come. As I described before, I was somebody who had a really hard time getting sober. You know, I'm a low-bottom drunk. I'm a chronic alcoholic, and I like to drink. And a lot of my symptoms of my alcoholism started long before I drank. And those were things like as soon as I got in trouble, as soon as anybody said no to me, as soon as I didn't get what I wanted, I would run away. And I started running away at about the age of 12, and that was it. There was never any forethought, any plan to it. It's not like I ran away to California or anything like that. I would just run away from home because I didn't like the answers I was given, and I didn't want to accept responsibilities for what I had done. And for me, that really carried its way through many years into my alcoholism, and then after that as well, after I started drinking. The topic here is letting go of old ideas and thinking about that, you know, for me, because I'm a thinker. I think everything out, for me, it's about letting go of all ideas, any ideas. You know, and because everything, you know, we've heard it so many times that all my best ideas landed me here, you know, and or landed me in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's where it started. But I had, you know, I had numerous treatments. I was in many jails. I was in psychiatric institutions. And I just, from the time I was 15, there were some things that had happened to me. And every time I went into these, you know, institutions or treatment centers, you know, I'd drop one of those bombs on them, and then off they go into some therapeutic, treatment for Jane. And the bottom line is that I was an alcoholic. The bottom line is that I couldn't accept responsibility for my behavior or my actions. I could not be accountable for my life, and I didn't want to. And I'd gotten to the point where, you know, after a number of treatments where I had finally, you know, managed to sober up for a bit. I sobered up for about 5 years. And during that time, I kind of really started to like Alcoholics Anonymous and thought I would, go into counseling. So I went to college for a couple years and got my counseling degree and went to work as a chemical dependency counselor. And talk about the blind leading the blind. And I still look back, and in my prayers every now and then I'll say, God, you know, please keep an eye out on some of those women. And the only thing I had going for me at that time is that my husband was a very strong member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was meeting with a sponsor on a daily basis, and he was doing all the right stuff. And he'd come home, and I wasn't doing any of it. And he'd come home, and he'd, you know, tell me in conversation what his sponsor had said, what his sponsor had told him to do, things like that. And then that's what I would pass on to these other people. And, it could have been worse. You know? But anyway, so finally when I had had enough, when I had, I literally crawled into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the last time. For the second to last time. I was so beat up. My body couldn't carry me anymore. It was in the summertime, and I'd been walking around the streets with bare feet for so long that the entire bottoms of my feet were scorched and blistered and burnt, and I couldn't walk anymore, you know. And I crawled, you know. Right before that, I'd been going into Target to get my Sunday morning bottle of Listerine. And I was walking out of there, and I'd been with my husband. He'd been sober for a while, and I was back out there drinking, and after, you know, relapsing. And I remember walking down the street, and I saw him in our car go through the intersection, and I knew where he was going. He was going to the Sunday morning meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in St. Cloud. And I looked at him, and I just started crying, because I would have given anything to be in that car. But because of my decisions, my fears, you know, my unwillingness, I couldn't. And so there I went with my bottle of Listerine. Not too long later, I crawled back into the doors of that meeting. And, you know, they'd always tell me, find an old-timer. And so I went and I sat myself in the lap of the oldest guy I could find there. And just started blubbering and crying and all that. And thankfully, a woman came up to me after the meeting, and she gave me her card, and she says, if you want some help, you give me a call. And that's where my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous began. And for me, you know, when we talk about letting go of old ideas and things like that, it's I'd always had this, you know, this preconception that, you know, whatever it is that I was asked to do, you know, I had to understand it, you know. And my success in staying sober at that time depended on my ability to follow directions, the directions she had given me, regardless of what I knew why I was doing it, you know, or whether I wanted to or not, or what the outcome was going to be. I really thought that I had to know the answers to those three things before I did anything, and because my fear was just running rampant, you know, and somehow I was able to do those things. I was able to follow those directions, and they were very, very simple. You know, and much simpler than therapy. And, you know, go to a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at least the same time, the same place, you know, and put some consistency in your life. To meet with her once a week, no matter what, to give the world my best and to bring her my worst. And to stay away from that first drink, you know, and that's what I did, you know. And I came into, you know, this relationship with her and thinking, you know what? you know, I've been a counselor, you know, is this all? You know, I really need to do like a thorough fourth and fifth step, and then I need to go on and do this and this and this. And I'm telling her what I think I need to do, and she said, no, you're going to do the basics so that you can build a foundation so when life on life's terms comes along, you're not going to crumble. And somehow that made sense to me. So that's what I did, you know, and I did that for a period of time. And when the timing was right in her eyes, I started going through the steps. And one of the things that I like to talk about, you know, what she taught me for the first 3 years of my sobriety was consistency and self-discipline. Both of those things I lacked completely. I had no consistency and no self-discipline. And she taught me through her actions and through her words and through her meetings with me what those things were and how to incorporate them into my life. But when it got down to my fifth step, I had a lot of history, and my fifth step started at 9 o'clock in the morning and ended at 9 o'clock at night, and I had 3 cigarette breaks, and that was it. And I had a lot. But the reason I had a lot is that I was so desperate to hang on to this deal because I didn't want to go back, that I knew that I had to be completely honest about everything and I didn't want to leave out anything. And we got to one of the question about the employer, and she said, and I said to her, I said, well, you know I've hurt my employer in certain areas, and I said, but the one thing that I do, I just want to tell you about, is that I do take mental health days once in a while. And she said, you're not going to do that anymore. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I have the sick time. I'm just not sick. I just need a mental health day. And she says, you're not going to do that. You have a responsibility to your employer to show up. And when you don't show up because of a mental health day, which is exactly how she said it, you know, you put them in a bind, and you're not going to do that anymore. And again, because I knew I had to be rigorously honest, you know, and with this deal that if I tried to, you know, if I lied on one thing, because that was my big problem, if I lied on anything, you know, I was going to get drunk. I set about for 2 hours trying to convince her that was okay. I screamed, I kicked, I cried, I begged, I guilted. I did everything I could to try and get her to change her mind. And she just sat back and said, no, you're not going to do that anymore. And finally, after 2 hours of that, I was spent. And I said, fine, I won't do that anymore. And I'm happy to tell you that nearly, you know, 6 years later, I have not taken one single mental health day at work. All right. And the cool thing is that I've learned how to do things like schedule vacation days, you know, where you can actually go out in the public. You know, I when you're off of work and you can go to the grocery store and you don't have to go back to work and you know, and pretend like you've been sick, you know. So anyway, how are we doing? Okay. Anyway, let's see here. Great. So anyway, you know, in this idea of letting go of old ideas, you know, another area for me is fear. You know, and I have been filled with fear for a long time. And one of the other things that happened in my fifth step, and when my sponsor and I talked about what happened to me as a child, which was, you know, it wasn't pretty, and it came up in every treatment I was ever in and every therapeutic session and all that. And during my fifth step, I shared those things with my sponsor, and she said to me, she said, you know, Jane, she says, I'm really sorry those things happened to you as a child. They should not have happened. But you are responsible for your recovery today. And that was the first time I had ever been told that. Out of all those treatments and all that therapy, nobody had said, you know what, you are responsible today in spite of that. You know, and that put me on a whole different plane. You know, it's like, you know what, no longer could I use that as a crutch. You know, because that's what it had been for me, as a crutch. And it was one of those things that stood in the way of my getting sober, you know, because it was the reason why I drank. It was the reason why it was okay for me to drink, you know, and I couldn't use that anymore. And, you know, there was some relief in that. There really was, you know. And so from that point, we really started getting busy. Fear, you know, my husband told me, you know, for years, he says, Jane, you got more boogeymen than anybody I've ever met, you know, and I had that. I was afraid of everything. You know, and we talk about, you know, I'm an all or nothing, you know, and there's a lot of times that I will not do something because of fear, because I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I don't know how I'm going to look to you. you know, and I'm afraid, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, you know, and both being sponsored and being a sponsor, you know, have helped me to walk through fear, you know. And that's the greatest gift I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the ability to walk through fear. Just put one foot in front of the other, no matter what, you know, and leave the outcome to God. And my experience with that has been is that every time I have done that, you know, and I pray and I just do the footwork, it's been okay. It may not have turned out the way I thought it should have, but it's been okay. And for me, those things have been faith builders. That's how I built a faith and a power greater than myself, was through walking through those fears. And believe me, it still happens today. You know, I haven't conquered all of them, and I don't think I ever will. But today, I'm able to walk through them, and that's a gift. You know, in the second appendix in the back of the big book, under the spiritual experience, in the very last paragraph, one of the things it talks about that is contempt prior to investigation. And I remember when I read that, you know, contempt prior to investigation, that described my life. You know, I determined, you know, what it was and you know, if I was going to do it and how it was going to turn out, or I wasn't going to do it at all, you know, and I would just cast it aside. So, you know, it's like I would get a kick out of the saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, take what you want and leave the rest. Well, the things that I chose to take, you know, like the coffee and fellowship and him and, you know, those... And the things that I left were the principles, you know, and the program and the steps and the service work and sponsorship. Those are the things I left. So I really try to turn that around these days. You know, I use those words lightly, you know. And then I had my second sponsor, she taught me about the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor, she was hardcore. I mean, hardcore. And she snapped her fingers and I jumped. But my second sponsor, she taught me about the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was so important for me to learn. And she helped work with me on my honesty because, again, because of that fear, I became a habitual liar, just a habitual liar, you know. And so trying to let go of that person and, letting go of those things, she said something to me once, and she said, Jane, if you can learn to admit when you've been dishonest, you can learn to be honest. You know, and for me, that was a solution. I needed that solution to be able to admit when I've been dishonest instead of hiding it. I can learn to be honest, you know, and so I started doing that. I go to her and I say, you know what, I just told a blatant lie, you know, and I don't know why I did it. And we talked through it. Usually it had something to do with ego or fear. You know, we talked through it. And with some of those things, you know, after a while, I just got tired of going to her and saying, you know what, you know, I started walking away from dishonesty and more on the path of honesty, and that's wonderful. My life today, I love some of the very, very simple things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the prescription that Dr. Bob wrote for us, you know, that I truly believe in. You know, I try to keep this thing as simple as possible. I've done all the therapeutic stuff, you know, and I keep this thing very simple. And one of the things that I believe in, you know, when it comes down to the, you know, life in itself, you know, the question to be asked with any decision is it right or is it wrong? You know, there's no dissecting it. There's no, you know, making excuses. Is it right or is it wrong? You know, and those are the ideas that I live with today. And then, just trying to do the right thing. But Dr. Bob wrote that prescription, and it said, trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's how I live my life today, for the most part, to the best of my ability. Trust God, clean house, help others. You know, and I'm surrounded today with people. You know, my biggest thing when I was a kid is I wanted to have friends, and I wanted to have a lot of them. But, you know, today I have all the fellowship in my life that I could ever, ever dream of. You know, I have a wonderful home with a husband who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. They are the true joy of my sobriety. You know, in that my sponsor, from the very first moment she started sponsoring me, she says, you are now in training to help others. You are in training to help others. And when I was 8 months sober and she felt like I wasn't going to kill anyone or
whatever, she got me out there and started working with others exactly the way she had worked with me. And so that's what I do, you know, and I get to share this thing with other people, and I get to see the light go on in their eyes. And I get to help them walk through those fears, sometimes the very same fears that I had, you know. So this whole thing for me, you know, and talking about letting go of old ideas has been about a change of attitude. You know, how I look at things, how I react to things. Today, I try to step back a little bit, ask God for help, you know, and just do the footwork and just keep it very, very simple. And I'm so honored to be here and to be a part of this international. I just can't get enough of it. And to have brought one of my sponsees here with me, you know, for her first experience at an international convention of Alcoholics Anonymous and see all you wonderful people, you know, and this powerful organization that we are a part of. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. How many people are at their first international?
Woo!
Wow. Hold your seats. Let's see, our next speaker is going to be Laura J. from D.C.
Good morning. My name is Laura and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. Wow. I'm telling you, this is absolutely wonderful. This is absolutely wonderful. I had no idea about what I was going to speak on, and then this morning I started thinking about it, and, you know, and every time somebody would ask me what I was speaking on, I would always say, hold it on to old ideas, not let go. And I guess that says a whole lot about how I handle this, but I made a few notes this morning, and then as you were speaking, it just kicked up so much, and I probably get emotional. You start talking about the international convention and the magnitude of this and the friendships and all the benefits that I received from being a member here of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I want to do, I want to read the thought for the day, because like I said, I really didn't think about this until this morning. Okay. The best for today. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. That's in Alcoholics Anonymous, page 60. Just as a sculptor will use different tools to achieve different effects in creating a work of art, the Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps are used to bring about results in my own life. I do not overwhelm myself with life's problems, how much work needs to be done. I let myself be comforted in knowing that my life is now in the hands of my higher power, a master craftsman who is shaping each part of my life into a unique work of art. By working my program, I can be satisfied knowing that in doing the best that we can for today, we are doing all that God asks for us. And when I read that this morning, I said, that is right on time. And some days that applies to me. Some days it does not. Some days I can get caught up in those old ideas and think about where I should be, where I could be, am I doing enough, and all of that kind of stuff. But on the good days when I'm grounded spiritually, it's easy just to let go and let God and know that God is doing for me what I can't do for myself. And that is working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with the steps and wanting to do the right thing and be the right thing. You know, with this international convention, and you were talking about two important things happened to me this year, two very important things. And I used to say that these were the highlights of my sobriety, but they're the highlights of my life. And one of them is being invited to speak here at the International Convention, and the other was being elected a delegate of D.C., of Area 13. And this is another delegate, and as a result of being elected delegate, I became a nerd. We are nerds.
Northeast Region of Delicates. And when we went to the conference, we have nerd pins. We have nerd pins, and they have moving eyes, and and they're real nice. And I was wearing them. I was just so proud. And my daughter came up the spirit of the weekend. She said, aren't you a little ashamed? And I was wearing it with pride. So the thing about being a nerd. Todd?
Try again.
Okay. It's all fine.
Test.
Are there any convention volunteers in the room?
Who? Oh, who's the one that got
it? Yeah, it's not working. We got feedback in a wind day. Laura can handle it.
Okay, they said I can handle it.
You go, girl.
They said I can handle it.
All right, man. Okay, I got to go back to the corner on this one. Because I'm going to tell you, when I was out there on the corner, I could talk loud when I needed to.
I remember when I first came here, and there was a guy, Joe M. from Arkansas. And so I lived in Arkansas. I'm a little country girl. I live in North Carolina, Arkansas. But I had a problem with being an alcoholic. When I first came here, you know, I was young. I was 25.
25
is not young now when you come in, but at that time,
if you were 25 years old and came into AA, I mean, you were really young, and the older people would look at you and they would be very supportive. But sometimes you had that little thing in your head about maybe I had another one. Did I do the right thing? But anyway, Joe had a problem with the alcoholic. And he took the word alcoholic and broke it down to me what alcoholics was from this point on. And he said, an alcoholic is a life consisting of helping others live in continuous sobriety. Right, yeah. And that's the way that I felt, too. And once he told me that that's what an alcoholic was from that point on, I was all right with being an alcoholic. And I just learned so much from him. Last night I met a guy, the guy might be here. I always meet people. I've always been one of those folks, especially if you got a name in front of your name. Okay? This guy's name was Turtle Jim. You know, and when people have names like that, I just love them. I just love them here. And we were down in the problem line in the hotel, and he was complaining, and he was telling me what's wrong with DSA and everything, and so we had a real, real good discussion, but it wasn't an argument. And there used to be a time when I would have arguments. And what came out of it, and delegates will be happy to hear this, but what came out of it, we really had a good conversation. We were talking about holding on to old ideas, doing the easier, softer way about things that he was complaining about. But it came down to what we could agree on. His group didn't have a GSR. And he had given me all this information to take back to GSA about all the things that GSA had done wrong with the convention and everything. Oh, we're back now. And how I knew, it's still not working, but how I knew all this stuff that I was able to tell him, because they were doing the same kind of things that I do. I knew from experience. You know, I knew about all the slick stuff and the easier, softer way and doing things the whole way. I knew all of that. And everything he was saying, I said, I bet they did this. And he says, yeah. So it was really, really great. And as a result of coming here, you know, I've met people from all over the country. And anybody, there was a lot of hands that went up about their first international convention. And I've met people who would be lifetime friends from different places. I've met people, we had friends that we fellowshiped with in D.C. from Kentucky. And when you were talking about, you know, how we could, look, that's the upside. I can't hang like I used to. I hung out last night till 4 o'clock. And I'm glad to see some of the people who hung out with me last night till 4 o'clock in the morning to show up this morning, too. But I'm just glad to be here. But even with, when we talk about how, because I was real good with being judgmental about people. I was real good about making assumptions about people. The folks, I was sharing with someone this morning about the folks that we met from Kentucky. I met this one guy 5 years ago at a marathon meeting at an international convention. We stood outside, there was 3 of us, and we had our own meeting for about 2 meetings before we even went inside. I mean, we talked about everything, and if anybody wants to take a 5th step that they've been holding on and not doing, grab somebody here, you may not never see them again. I mean, you can tell them everything, you know. But I'm telling you, we had the best time, and we stood out there, and we talked about everything. We talked about the fellowship. We talked about ourselves. We just talked about everything. So we went to Akron, Ohio, and we saw these people, and we spoke to them, and they were kind of mean. And we said, you know, they all funny and stuff from Kentucky. You know, why they acting so cute? Later on, somebody had talked to this guy, and he said, you know, I met a lady named Laura. And they said, well, she's here. And we had hooked up, so we hooked up with the people from Kentucky. And, you know, sometimes you never know when you make these assumptions. These people had a terrible bus trip. The bus driver stopped every 15 minutes to smoke a cigarette. They were 6 hours late coming in. They had problems at the hotel desk. So what we saw was the aftermath of that. And we spoke to them, and they didn't smile and say, hey, you know. So, and so that is my AA example about contempt prior to investigation. You know, because had we not hooked up later, we've had a lasting relationship over the years that we could not have had we held on just to that one assumption about how they act. They act funny. You know, they had a rough time. And there's been so many experiences like that. Everything that I've learned in AA. You know, I had those books about everything I learned in kindergarten. I've learned everything in AA. I had to relearn everything about life, about people, about everything. And what I found out is some of the things that I was taught were correct. You know, some of the stuff my parents and them told me were right. But it's like the older you get, the more you remember what they said. And I talk more about what my grandmother said, what my mother said, now that I'm almost 50, than I ever did in my life, you know. And that's because so much of the stuff that you all are saying is the same thing. And what it is about learning right from wrong, learning to do, even if I make mistakes in here, even if I've made mistakes, and I've made a lot of mistakes in here, but knowing the right thing and the wrong thing, you know. And it's been good, and I just try to just be the best person that I can be. See, I'm getting old. I might be able to continue to say this. No, I ain't going to even say it here. See, y'all think I'm a nice girl. Let me not say that here. I felt my cool would be getting back about what I was going to say. But this is absolutely a tremendous honor to be a part of anything like this. And I want to say again to the people who are here for the first time, when you see how Alcoholics Anonymous has affected people all over the world, you start looking at the name tags and seeing where people are from and talking to people about the length of sobriety. I was speaking to some folks over here, and one of them has an anniversary 1 year next week. She's right here in front row. I forget names, so forgive me. And the person she's with, her sponsor, has 30 years. Isn't that wonderful? Okay, you laugh at that one. And I told her sponsor, and it's only here, like I told her sponsor, I said, you're not even an old-timer yet. You got 10 years before you're an old-timer. But when you see that kind of sobriety and you see how AA works, in our area, I'm looking at one of our past delegates, Chad. And I want to show you about AA. Chad, could you stand up for a minute? And Gabe, can you stand up? And I'm going to tell the story, and I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to tell you a story about how AA works. Wait a minute, stay. I want y'all to stand up for a minute. I got to tell the story. I want them to see this. I want the visual. Okay, Gabe is a person. Chad is a past delegate, knows everything about our kind of loves, AA, anything you want to know about, AA, Bill Wilson, got pictures with him and Bill, the whole nine yards, okay? That's Chad. Gabe is Gabe. Gabe is our entertainer. Gabe, you know, every area has a Gabe, okay? Gabe is a wonderful, Gabe is my best friend. Gabe will curse you out in a second, okay? So, hey. Okay, everybody has one of those kinds. 25 years ago, Gabe is also our archives chair in our area. And I said Chad know all that stuff, right? 25 years ago, Chad, y'all see Chad is an older white man, right? See, that's why I want y'all to see the visuals, but hey. Chad took Gabe, who will cuss a person out in a second. And he's still working on that, okay? Chad took Gabe to treatment. You see what I'm saying? 25 years ago, and Gabe has been sober ever since. Yes, but I'm talking about him. And now the two of them together work on the archives and the history of AA and everything 25 years later. So you never know what's going to happen as a result of the love and stuff that we get. You never know where your help is going to come from and all of that. And those are the kind of stories that I know that I can see, and I can see how AA works, and it doesn't have any color lines, any age lines or anything. And when I see the moderator kind of moving a little bit, I kind of know it's kind of like my time. And so with that, I just want to thank everybody for being here and for putting up and listening to me. And y'all are going to have a great time. And one more thing to the wives. For the guys who haven't been here before, they're going to cry tonight. They're going to cry. So when they start coughing and act like, for the macho guys, they're going to act like they're choking when the tears start coming down. Just bear with them. Just bear with them and pretend like you don't know they're crying.
Did Laura do a great job through that adversity with the mic or what, huh? Yeah. Thank you, Laura. And yeah, tonight, don't miss any of the big meetings at the Sky Dome if this is your first international, or even if it's your 12th. Well, they haven't been 12. But just get there. Okay, and our last speaker is going to be Les S. from New Brunswick.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Les, and I'm an alcoholic. And what a thrill. I don't know that I have ever in my life felt as humbled by anything as I was when I got the invitation to be here and to share with you this morning. And I want to thank my sponsor for submitting my name. I'm really blessed this morning because my current sponsor is here and my former sponsor is here, and the reason is simple. They're here to keep me honest. And they probably told me that in some way or other. By the grace of a higher power and by people like you, last Tuesday, I celebrated 37 years of sobriety. Thank you. And if you're impressed by that, in the back of the room is my former sponsor, he celebrated 32 years on Tuesday as well. Stand up, Warren. Where are you? There you are. I also happen to be from Newfoundland, and that is not an impediment to being an alcoholic, but I tell you, it helped a lot. And, of course, I have to tell you a Newfie joke, and you Americans who don't know about Newfie jokes are about to learn so. A Newfoundlander and his wife were married for about 55 years, and they were sitting on the porch in the swing on a day like today. And after about an hour, she looked at him and she said, "George." And he said, "Yes, Mary." She said, "How come you don't hold my hand like you used to?" So he reached over and he took her hand, and after 20 minutes she said, "George." And he said, "Yes, Mary." She said, "How come you don't put your arm around me like you used to?" And he put his arm around her and held her for about 20 minutes. And she said, "George." And he said, "Yes, Mary." She said, "How come you don't nibble on my ear like you used to?" So he got up and started to go to the house. And she said, "George, where are you going?" He said, "I'm going in to get my teeth." I needed to hear you laugh. God, as I understand him, has a great sense of humor. Okay? When we walked up here yesterday to register, I looked across the street, and here is the CDC Broadcast Center. Okay? And it was instantaneous. You know, I went back to that day in June of 1968 when, working for the CBC, I did what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a radio and television announcer, or as some people called it, pronouncer. And on a Saturday, the 28th of June, as a practicing alcoholic, I decided to help my neighbor kill a magnum of Johnny Walker. And somewhere in that whole episode, I went into a blackout. And somewhere around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I remembered I had to read the news that night. And what I'm about to tell you is secondhand information. It is alleged that I showed up at the CBC in Corner Brook, Newfoundland at about 6:40, and I picked up the news from the reception area, and I walked into a studio, and the lights came on, and so did the idiot. And I prided myself on the fact that I had never slurred or never staggered. But there's an important word in that whole scenario, yet. And on came the camera, and I got the sign, and this is what 100,000 people in western and central Newfoundland heard. "Good evening. Here's the CBC News." And it was all downhill from there. For the first minute and a half, they thought there was something wrong with the microphone. And there was. There was an idiot sitting behind it. And he was in an alcoholic blackout. And then they tried to get rid of me. Ever been in that situation where you got a drunk on a roll? And you're trying to get rid of them? And we have signs in television. And this sign means, "Wrap it up." So we had a floor director who was standing about 3 feet from me, going, and I was going blissfully on. Any similarity between what I was saying and what was on paper was a coincidence. And finally he got down in front of me like this, you know. And I'm still going blissfully on. And the director in the control room said, "If he gets to the end of the paragraph, then we cut him. Audio, stand by. Video, stand by." And I got to the end of the paragraph, and he said, "Cut." And 100,000 people wondered what the hell had happened to their television sets. What had happened before that was of immense importance. 3 months before, the set director at that television station gave me some information. And the information was very simple. I was pontificating on my greatness because I was doing it on my own. And he looked at me and he said, when you get tired of being sick and tired, call me. And I thought you'd be the last person on earth I'd call. I just did not like that man. He smiled a lot. He rattled the change in his pocket. He drove a black Chrysler. And he had everything I wanted and couldn't get. And in an alcoholic blackout, by God's grace, I looked at that same floor director on that Saturday night and said, for God's sake, Clancy, call Cliff. And he was so astounded that this egomaniac would even attempt anything close to humility or defeat. He said, what? And I said, please, I need help. And he made the call. He didn't have to tell Cliff what was wrong. Cliff was watching television. And I went, he picked up the body and he took it to an AA club. And he talked to me for about an hour and a half, and finally about 9:30 I came out of the blackout. And an hour later he took me home. And I got 3 telephone calls. Newfoundland is a big island in a small place. And my sister, Jane, okay, who was a nurse and the first person to tell me that I was an alcoholic, called me in Corner Brook. This had been the second event, by the way, in less than 2 years. I got drunk on radio, but didn't get away with it there. They can't see you. And she called me, and I clearly remember the conversation. She said, you've done it again? And I said, yes. She said, let me tell you this, and I want you to listen. If you ever again embarrass this family to the extent that you have tonight, you can consider yourself no longer my brother. Click. And then I got a call from a former boss who had worked hard to promote me and a former colleague who had taken the bottle away from me 21 months before. And I had some visitors that night. And I don't know if any of you have had visitors, but I suspect there might be a few who would relate to this. Little pink elephants and great big white rats. And some guy behind you with a paper garbage bag over his head, breaking panes of glass on your back. And at about 7:30, 8 o'clock that Sunday morning, I decided that the best thing I could do for my 2 sons and my wife was to run my car off 300 feet of Newfoundland Rock. And I had found the place. And anybody who tells me that God is not alive and well, I have something to tell you. I had showered and shaved. The only rationale I can come up with there is because I wanted to be a good-looking corpse. And I had determined that an accident like that could not be proven as suicide, and my children would inherit my group life insurance policy. And as I had my hand on the door, 20 seconds from the car that would take me to my death, the phone rang. And I don't have to tell you who was on the other end of the phone. It was my friend Cliff. And he said, how are you feeling? And I lied again. You don't tell people you're going to commit suicide. Not if you're me. Yeah. And he said, why don't you come down for a cup of tea and a chat? And I went down that afternoon. I made a left turn instead of a right. And it saved my life, and it gave me the greatest adventure that any human being could possibly imagine. What a trip this has been. What a trip. That afternoon, He talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked about him, and he told me about the miracles he had encountered, and he invited me to go to a meeting. And I figured I had no options, so I went to a meeting. And I was shaking like a leaf in an October hurricane. And I sat on my hands because I didn't want those drunks to see this television star shake. You know. And next door is the guy who gave me my first cup of AA coffee. I hugged him and thanked him again this morning. His name is Bill B. And I got in there, third seat from the right on the, you know, in that chair, and I'm just vibrating. And Bill B. came in, and he was dressed somewhat like I am this morning, shirt, tie, sports jacket, gray pants, shiny shoes. And I thought he was the AA doctor because he made an immediate, accurate diagnosis. He said, "You're not feeling very well, are you?" And I allowed he was right. He said, "Would you like something to drink?" And I thought, oh my God, this is what they do here. They wing you off. So, he went into the kitchen and he came out with a half-filled coffee mug. And in order for me to drink the coffee, I had to take my hands from behind my back, and I couldn't get it any closer than here. And he took the cup and he put it down by the chair and he went back in the kitchen and he came back with a teaspoon. And with those gray flannels and that lovely sports coat and that shirt and tie, he knelt in front of me and he spoon-fed me my first cup of sweet AA coffee. And something happened. Thank you. Yeah, he deserves it. He deserves it. Something happened. I knew that he knew how I felt. And I knew that he knew that I knew. And that's the beginning of a miracle. And if you're here and you're relatively new, may I plead with you. Stay till the miracle happens. Stay. Because I will assure you, based on nothing more than my own experience, that the miracle will happen. It will happen. I got to get to the theme. When I got the letter, I shook for a couple of days, and then I thought, oh my God. I mean, this is truly a terrific honor, and the other two ladies have said it. And it really is something, when you've been where I've been, to be able to be here with you and to feel how I feel. This is really an incredible thing. Letting go of old ideas. All of my old ideas were negative, and all of them were self-conceived. Isn't that amazing? You know? Old idea that I was different. Reality, I was full of fear. That's the truth. Old idea, my condition was because of others. Reality, I am responsible for my actions and behaviors. Old idea that I could do it alone. Reality, that I trusted no one. The first person that I can honestly say that I trusted in my entire life was my friend Cliff. And that was not easy to achieve. We would have Tuesday night meetings, or rather Thursday night meetings, at a Chinese restaurant in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland, and he would begin every one of these meetings, just he and I, you know, sponsee, sponsor. And he'd stick his finger under my nose, and he'd ask the same two questions every Thursday night at the beginning of the conversation. He'd say, "How do you feel? And do you want to get well?" And I would say, "I think," and he'd say, "Less." I didn't ask you what you thought. I asked you what you felt. This went on for about 3 months, and one Thursday night he said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "I feel." And he said, "Thanks be to God, I thought you were dead." And then he would fire this, "Do you want to get well?" question at me. And I'd say, what fool in their right mind would answer no to that? And he'd say, this is what you're going to do. If you truly want to get well, this is what you're going to do. And he would stick his finger right under my nose. And there were times I wanted to bite it. There were times I wanted to... I swear to you, I contemplated homicide with that man 100 times. And he would get to the core, you know. But I came to trust him. And I have come to love him in the most remarkable way. He's still alive. He has Alzheimer's. He has 2 legs amputated. But he is whole. In my mind, he is whole and he is precious. Old idea that willpower and intellect would get me through. Reality, I was powerless. That's something for me to admit, that I was powerless. But Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that. Old idea that I could control any situation, reality, my ego was in the way. I was an egomaniac. I was going to show them all how it was done. Old idea, asking for help was a sign of weakness. Reality, reaching out is a sign of strength. Old idea, forget about the past. Reality, making amends is a necessity. Old idea, God was unloving and punishing. Reality, God, as I understand him, is loving, compassionate, and kind, just like you. And I want to tell you how I came to believe that. My dad never drank in his life. And I had a great struggle in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to find this higher power that you talked about. And I was in San Francisco at a young people's conference back in the early 70s. I was a young person then. And I met a man who jarred me a bit. And on Sunday afternoon, I was flying across the continental United States. And I knew where the answer to my dilemma lay. And I knew the man who had the answer. I got back. By then, I'd been transferred by the CDC to Halifax. And I knew that my dad had the answer. So I called him and I said, I'd like to come home and I'd like to go fishing with you. He was an inshore fisherman. He worked hard all his life. But he was a man of faith and strength. And we went out fishing and we sat. He had gone to AA meetings. I'll tell you how perceptive he was and how dumb I was. I took him to an AA meeting in Halifax, and when we got home that night, I said, well, Skipper, what did you think of the meeting? He said, bless my son, I've been going to church for 60 years. That is the most practical Christianity I've ever seen. Okay, he got it long before I did. He's here this morning in spirit. He's with me always in spirit. And we sat in his boat. And I knew what I had to do, and I was scared to death, almost as scared as I was when I walked in here this morning. And I said, why do you believe like you do? He said, I just do. I said, I know that. But how and why? And for a long time he was silent, and I felt that I had invaded his space. And then he said, you remember last year at Christmas? You and I went Christmas shopping because he would come visit at Christmas time after my mother died. I said, yes, I remember. He said, we went to a shopping mall. I said, yes. He said, we passed a bookstore. I said, did we? He said, yes. And I thought, what the hell's this got to do with it? He said, there was a rack of books in front of that store, and every book had the same cover. Who has seen the wind? And I thought, I said, you know, Dad, that's W.O. Mitchell's book. I've interviewed him. He said, I don't care about that. And I still wanted to impress him. He said, I didn't even read the book. I just read the cover. He said, Les, and he pointed toward the little fishing town where we grew up. He said that they tell me there are more widows in that town per capita than any other town in Canada. I said, yes, I can believe that, Dad. He said, do you know why that is so? And I said, yeah, their husbands were lost at sea. He said, and what caused these men to be lost at sea? I said, storms. Their dories or their schooners or their trawlers were upset. He said, that's right. And he said, my son, what's associated with storms? I said, wind. He said, right, wind. Now, he said, you're a smart fellow. You went to college. And you probably know why we have wind. And I said, well, Dad, it isn't very complicated. It's just a low-pressure system chasing a high. And he said, see, I don't understand that at all. I just know we have wind. And then I knew where he was going. And he said, Les, my son, I've been going to church and trying to live well for 70 years. And you know, he said, I have never seen God. And he said, I've been fishing for 55 years. And I've been on the water when it hasn't been fit for dog or devil to be out here, and I've almost drowned 100 times because of the wind. But Les, my son, I have never seen the wind. I have seen what the wind can do. And he said, I would be a fool and a maniac to deny that the wind exists. I would be just as much a fool and maniac to deny that God exists. I haven't had a problem with the higher power since that day. And my dad said, you know, he had never seen God, and I believe that he had, and he didn't recognize it, because I have seen God, and I am now seeing God as I understand him. That power of good that is so prevalent in all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw it last night in the laughter and the joy as the music was playing. And I see it this morning reflected in your eyes. I see that power of good that is so immense and so all-encompassing that it brings me to tears time after time after time. The higher power is here, and he's within all of us. I truly believe that. And it is that power that enables us to change these old ideas to ideas of positive personality change that the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. I truly believe that we are a blessed people. I believe, and I sat last night and watched after a while as people went by and the smiles and the laughter and hugging, and I sat on a concrete wall over there and I looked and this thought came to me. Did Dr. Bob and Bill, in their wildest imagination, ever think that this could be a reality? And I believe they did. Old idea, life is a dreadful experience. Reality, life is adventure, discovery, and joy. That's what AA is all about for me. It's discovery. It's finding out about Les. And the best way to find out about Les is to talk to you. Because every person I've ever talked to in Alcoholics Anonymous has held up a mirror. We are all a reflection of each other, I believe. And I believe that if we allow ourselves to interact and share experience, strength, and hope, that we will indeed find the panacea that we look for in the bottom of a bottle. It has been so with me. Old idea. There is no solution. Reality. Page 164, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Let me walk you through that one more time with a final story. When I moved to Halifax with the CBC, I met one of the most articulate men I've ever encountered in my life. His name was Doug Fraser. He was not an alcoholic. He was the senior radio news editor, and he wrote well. And if he gave you a newscast, you were assured you weren't going to have any problems reading it. And he discovered through conversation that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'd like to read that big book that you fellows had. And I said, I'd like you to read it, Doug. And I brought him in my big book, and he took it home. And a week or so later, he came back. And I said, well, what did you think? Well, he said, from a literary point of view, it's an awful book. But he said, from a spiritual point of view, it rivals the Bible. And I said, I have one problem with the book, and that's on page 164. Everything else I accept. He said, oh, really? I said, yeah. He said, what is that? I said, the last paragraph begins, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. And I think the word abandon is wrong. He said, I will prove to you that the word is absolutely correct in context. And the next day he came in with the first volume of the Funkenwagnall, the first volume of the Oxford Dictionary, and the first volume of the Webster's. And he had penciled the important explanation. The word abandon, fourth or fifth meaning in each of these dictionaries, says this, give freely of yourself. Now let me do it again. Give freely of yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Steps 4 and 5 of the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. Give freely of what you find and join us. The paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, is that you keep it by giving it away. And I know no other program, no other recovery process that works as effectively as that. And Wilson said when he wrote that, if you do these simple things, then we will give you an ironclad guarantee. You will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road. And here's what's happened over 37 years. I have met you. I have met you. In person and in spirit, across this continent, I have met you in the most remarkable ways in the fellowship of the Spirit. And what does that mean? That means very simply to me that this morning when I came here and was sitting here, Harry came over. And he shook my hand and he said, Brother Les, good to see you. Harry and I go back 30 years. And sometimes we don't touch base for 5 years. But that's irrelevant. We are always with each other in the fellowship of the Spirit. It's that Spirit that you meet somebody on an escalator or in a coffee shop or on the street, and they say, how you doing? How you doing? Don't say a darn word about alcoholism. Says nothing about AA. But we know that they're saying, how is your day? Are you well and sober today? Is everything all right in your life? You know? That's the fellowship of the Spirit of good that I believe is in all of us. And if you're having trouble with this program, may I tell you that that Spirit of good is within you, regardless of how many times you've gone in or out. You see, the great thing about that fellowship of the Spirit is that it is filled with unconditional love. And it is important that we remember that. And Wilson said, you will surely meet some of us as you trudge. What a wonderful word. What a wonderful word. He didn't say hop, skip, and jump along. He said trudge the road of happy destiny. For me to stand here this morning and tell you that I've had 37 years of blissful ha-ha-ha sobriety would be a damn lie. I've had periods of pain. Great pain. But Alcoholics Anonymous has always brought me back. I haven't had to take a drink to soothe that pain ever again since that day in 1968. And I have met you. I have met you on this road of happy destiny. And I know what my destiny is. My destiny is to live one day at a time. Because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have now learned how to do that. With some degree of success. To live one day at a time, to interact with you, to follow the steps to the best of my ability. And if I do that, I am assured that the destiny will be fulfilled. I have a wonderful life. I have happiness and joy within. And that never happened until I found you and that higher power. I thank you for being attentive. I thank you for your love. I thank you for your lives. But most of all, I thank you for mine. God bless you.
What a way to start the convention. Three great speakers. Let's give them another round. And just as a reminder, the tapes and CDs of this meeting will be available in Hall E. And for anyone who cares to join me, we'll close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us